This is Focus 580 here on WILL AM. Good morning. My name is David Inch. On our program today, we are going to continue to try to have some discussion of the events that took place on Tuesday and what they mean, and give you an opportunity also to ask questions, to make comments, as we do any day here on this program. And we have two shows planned here for this morning. And, of course, we also want you to know that if there is breaking news, we will go to National Public Radio for whatever coverage they provide. And, in fact, we're told that about 10:30 this morning, there will be a statement from Mr. Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell. And when that happens, we will go to National Public Radio so you can have the opportunity to hear what Mr. Powell has to say. We will start out, however, here this morning talking with Dan Byman. He's director of the RAND Middle East Center in Washington, D.C. And we'll be talking this morning, trying to get some better understanding of the problem of terrorism, what it is all about, how we can deal with it. And as, of course, we talk, as always, questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that Cigna will travel. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Byman, hello.
Yes, hello.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
There are a number of, I guess, specific questions that I have, but perhaps I just ask in a very general and open way for you to share whatever thoughts you have now at this point about what happened on Tuesday and what comes next.
As far as what happened on Tuesday, my thoughts, I assume, are the same of almost every American. Outrage, horror, and I would have to add surprise. I think that I and many other people who follow radical groups were not expecting this level of attack, that a group could do something this daring, this sophisticated, and this bloody. I have to say, honestly, surprised me, and I think surprised even most experts on the subject. As far as what we do next, this is, of course, the huge question. My biggest concern is that what we do next is both measured and prudent, that we don't immediately strike, we don't immediately lash out until we know exactly what we intend to do. There is understandable outrage throughout this country and a demand to do something, but when you get into any specifics, it becomes very clear that we don't know what exactly we should do, we don't know against whom, and we don't know with what. And until we've thought through these questions, I'd rather see us exercise restraint. And then once we have thought through them, then the time can come to apply the full might of American power appropriately.
Yes. I'm very interested in the candor of your statement about the fact that you and perhaps other people who track terrorism were surprised by the events of Tuesday. And we know that now for some decades we've been concerned about the possibility of terrorism. And I'm sure that the intelligence apparatus of this country has been doing what it can to gather information. And I believe that it is the case that some number of maybe a couple of the suspected terrorists were actually on FBI watch lists because of their association with Osama bin Laden. I guess to me it seems a little bit surprising that people who are experts in this area would be surprised given the real possibility of something like this, although perhaps not of this scale.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. The surprise comes in the scale. It's no surprise that there are people out there trying to kill Americans. It's no surprise that they are skilled. It's no surprise that Osama bin Laden and his organization is anti-American. But many people who study terrorism date the advent of modern terrorism at around 1968. And between 1968 and 2000, roughly 2,000 Americans died from international terrorism total. And here we have one day where I think we'll be lucky, frankly, if it is only 2,000. One day where that total was instantly exceeded. And I think many people were, if you had asked me is it plausible for a group like Bin Laden to hijack a plane and attack the World Trade Center? I would say yes, certainly. But the surprise on having four simultaneous hijackings on multiple targets was a scale that I had not anticipated. And obviously, I think many of us are feeling saddened and chastened and that we did not do what we try to do best.
Mm-hmm. The last thing that now I've heard is that the U.S. government is estimating that perhaps as many as 50 people altogether somehow were involved in this act. Do you think that that seems reasonable? Could there, in fact, be more people one way or another involved? Or I suppose there's really no way to answer the question.
Well, it depends very much on how you define involved. And I'm not trying to be, have a legal or picky definition here. Mm-hmm. It's a question of, by involved, do we mean the person who actually went on the plane and overpowered the pilot and flew it into a building, or do we mean the person who trained that person in hand-to-hand combat? Do we mean the person who gave the terrorist money? Do we mean the person who provided them with a sanctuary in which to receive orders? Do we mean the people who orchestrated the master plan? Each question you answer and the wider you draw the circle, the more people are implicated. I think the figure of 50 people is the smallest figure in terms of those immediately involved in the specific attack. But the support base and the leadership base is actually much, much larger.
Mm-hmm. I think that rightly so, we have all been cautioned about speculating as to who might be involved. That particularly that Muslim Americans, Arab Americans are very concerned with the deflection of the kind of anger and frustration that everyone feels upon them. Having said that, it also seems to be the case that as far as the government is concerned, that their chief suspect is Osama bin Laden. How do we negotiate this path between talking in a sort of appropriate way about who might be responsible and not veering into sort of wild and irresponsible speculation?
Well, it takes a recognition, which I think is found in not only in government but among most Americans, that there are 1.3 billion Muslims throughout the world. Only a fraction of a fraction support this sort of activity, support the killing of innocents to advance their cause. So what you're really talking about are groups of criminals. And every religion, every society, every country has criminals. And in some countries, there are more of them. In some countries, they are given freer rein. But that's really the way to think of them. These criminals organize themselves under an Islamic rubric. But responsible Islamic voices in the Middle East, and of course in the West, denounce this sort of activity because they believe that it does not represent what Islam stands for. And Islam, being one of the world's great religions, is a religion of tolerance and peace.
That leads to one of the other questions that was on my mind, and that is how it is that the government responds to this act. There are perhaps two different ways that we might think about it that we've been talking about it. One would be to think of Tuesday's acts as criminal acts and then to pursue them with the elements of the U.S. justice system, like the FBI and police organizations and so forth. The other, and this seems to connect with the way that so many people in government, including the president, are talking about this, is to talk about it as an act of war, which would suggest that the way to pursue it is by military means. I think that there's rather significant implications in the way that we talk about this. And I wonder whether you think that one or the other of these is either more appropriate or more problematic. That is, on the one hand, talking about it as a criminal action, and the other hand, talking about it as an act of war.
Well, there are disadvantages to both, which is why they should not be seen as alternatives, but rather components of one overall policy. The law enforcement approach has disadvantages in that it only goes after a very narrow set of individuals whom we can build a legal case against. So it's talked that there were 50 individuals involved, and many of those perished. They were the ones who killed themselves. So we're talking, in that case, a very small group of people, and perhaps a few who directed them would be the ones brought to justice. But again, if you get to this broader network, then those people would remain unpunished under a law enforcement approach. Now, to get those people, an act of war approach might be more appropriate, but the problem with an act of war approach is it's very difficult if you don't have a government to go against. The United States could defeat Iraq. It could defeat Nazi Germany. And it's very hard to defeat a network. It's almost like punching a pillow in some ways, where it absorbs the network absorbs the damage very easily and regenerates itself. And as a result, acts of war are difficult without going after specific individuals, which is where a law enforcement approach helps.
Perhaps just real quickly here, I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Dan Byman. He is director of RAND's Middle East Center in Washington, D.C. And we're trying to talk about terrorism, what do we know about it, how we deal with it, and questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Given, again, going back to this issue, having to be perhaps a little bit careful about how we talk about who we think is responsible, and again noting the fact that it seems that the government is thinking that the network of Osama bin Laden was involved in this, if we would say that it might be someone else, and given the scale of this act, we know that it would take a large and well-coordinated and well-financed network to do it. If not Osama bin Laden, then who? Is there anyone else one could think of as being positioned, even setting aside the motive, being positioned to do such a thing?
Well, there are two possible groups. One is someone acting directly on behalf of the state, and states have large amounts of resources to devote to these issues. And as a result, it could be a number of states hostile to the United States. There are some terrorist groups that are extremely capable, the Lebanese Hezbollah being a primary example, that has conducted a range of very sophisticated attacks in the past. They have not gone after U.S. targets, particularly in the United States, for a very long time. And as a result, it would be a surprise if they were to do so. Also, many of the people that preliminary accounts indicate were involved in this are of different Arab nationalities, which has been a trademark of what bin Laden's organization has done in the past. Now, having said that, one thing that any person who works on terrorism learns immediately is how little we know. It is possible that existing groups have capabilities that we simply did not know until now, and it's possible that there are new groups out there that we hadn't heard of. And this is not a criticism of U.S. intelligence services. This is simply a fact that these groups specialize in staying below the radar screen, hiding, and at times there are surprises, and at times extremely ugly surprises.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. I want to do that, and we certainly would welcome other people who are listening. If you have questions for our guest, you certainly are welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana. That number, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you are, if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Here is a first caller to start with. They're in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Mm-hmm. I guess I have a problem with defining this whole situation in terms of counterterrorism and in terms of criminality, as the guest did. I think what we have here is political violence. That's what terrorism is usually defined as. I think there's an implicit definition kind of going around also that terrorism is the means that are left to powerless groups and individuals to combat what they see are their as their enemies. That's in a sense a biased definition that excludes the kind of terrorism that the United States, for example, perpetrates on the Middle East. But be that as it may, to define it as a kind of a technical problem, you know, in this kind of RAND syndrome that goes back to the Vietnam War, seems to me to miss the political aspects of it. I hate to see that this whole it becomes a kind of an exercise in cops and robbers and crime, you know, this kind of currently fashionable television program, crime scene investigation, and so forth. I mean, this really needs to be thought about at a deeply political level. It needs to be thought about in as objective a level as possible in terms of these are not criminals acting out of some evil intent of of that we commonly think of as individuals who do something for no reason. I mean, I'm not even sure if that's the right way to think about criminals in our own society at a petty level, but it certainly isn't the right way to think about this sort of action, which is rooted in years and years of the history of the relationship between the U.S. and these various Middle Eastern countries.
Well, Mr. Byman, you make whatever comment you can.
Sure. Well, I disagree with, obviously, with many of the particulars of the caller's remarks. He raises a very important point, which is what label to affix to these sorts of acts. No label does it justice, political violence, criminality, whatever you want to call it. The problem is if you assign it to political motives, it ends up being one of these unsolvable problems. If you say it was politically motivated, you try to understand the motivations. But in Bin Laden's case, the motivations are a very broad resentment of what the United States' role in the world is. And it's not the sort of thing that if the United States put more pressure on Israel or reduce support for Saudi Arabia, then it would make a difference to him.
Mr. Ryan, forgive me for interrupting. What we want to do right now at this point, National Public Radio is replaying a presidential news conference that took place a few minutes ago that they did not give us live coverage of, and I think we would like to go to that. So if you will bear with us, I think we will do that. Very good. We'll go to National Public Radio.
That's for the protection of the American people. It is important as we battle this enemy, we conduct ourselves that way. Secondly, I've been on the phone this morning, just like I was yesterday, and we'll be on this afternoon on the phone with leaders from around the world who express their solidarity with this nation's intention to rout out and to whip terrorism. They fully understand that an act of war was declared on the United States of America. They understand as well that that act could have easily been declared on them. These people can't stand freedom. They hate our values. They hate what America stands for. Many of the leaders understand it could have easily have happened to them. Secondly, they understand that unlike previous war, this enemy likes to hide. They heard my call loud and clear to those who feel like they can provide safe harbor for the terrorists, that we will hold them responsible as well. And they joined me in understanding not only the concept of the enemy, that the enemy is a different type of enemy. They joined me also in solidarity about holding those who fund them, who harbor them, who encourage them responsible for their activities. I'm pleased with the outpouring of support. Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, had a great visit this morning with His Royal Highness Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. I will continue to stay on the phone. And there is universal support for the American people, sadness in their voice, but understanding that we have just seen the first war of the 21st century. And there is universal approval of the statements I have made, and I am confident there will be universal approval of the actions this government takes. Yeah, stretch.
Mr. President, if this is a different kind of war, it might require perhaps a different kind of coalition. Many people believe that for a real war on terrorism to work, you'll need cooperation from governments that haven't necessarily done so in the past, specifically Pakistan and Afghanistan. Have you made any progress on that front?
I would refer you to the statements that the Pakistani leader gave about his, I don't have the exact words in front of me, but his willingness to work with the United States. And I appreciated that statement, and now we'll just find out what that means, won't we?
President Bush speaking to reporters today at the White House, NPR White House correspondent Don Gagne.
Well, we'll now cut again away from the coverage from National Public Radio. That was just apparently was an unplanned, impromptu meeting with reporters that the president had about 10 or 15 minutes ago, and we were not able to bring it to you live at the time because National Public Radio didn't provide the coverage for us. But we wanted at least to give you an opportunity to hear something of what the president had to say. And also, we are expecting sometime this morning, there will be a statement from the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. So again, when NPR lets us know that's going to happen and provides coverage, we will be able to do that. Our guest here this morning in this first hour, Focus 580, also is Dan Byman from the RAND Middle East Center in Washington. And we're talking about how it is we think about, understand, deal with terrorism. And we were forced to interrupt you in the middle of a thought there. Mr. Byman, if you wanted to go back and try to pick up where you were.
I'll try to quickly recapitulate.
Sure.
Move on. The problem with defining terrorism as a law enforcement issue or as a political issue is that both definitions have problems, both are inadequate, that you're dealing with such extreme people on the political side that really there are people within the mainstream of their communities consider them criminals, their means are criminal. On the other hand, their motivations are, in their eyes, altruistic. They are not in it for money, they are not in it for reasons we think of most criminals in the United States operating. But the line is very blurry here, and it's often useful to use both terms when you're talking about this phenomenon. Hmm.
I think, though, what the caller does point to is our need, and it's not going to be easy, I think, because often we don't pay the attention that we should to what happens outside the borders of the United States, but I think points to our need to understand the much larger political context into which this fits, and how it is, and in no way to condone what happened on Tuesday, but how it is that we might try to understand how a group like this would feel about the United States, and so would feel that it was appropriate, necessary to do something like this.
A group like this has many grievances with the United States. I'm going to talk in generalities first and then specifics. In generality, there's a resentment of the United States as a superpower. There's a belief that the United States throws its weight around, and that, in particular, that the United States tries to change other cultures and societies, often indirectly. The spread of U.S. movies, of U.S. fashions, and U.S. pop music has a tremendous influence in much of the developing world. We think of our ideals of Thomas Jefferson as being the sort of things that change people's opinions politically. In many countries in the world, they're more actually concerned and focused on Britney Spears. This idea of teenage female sexuality is very destabilizing. The idea of changes in relations between young and old, and things that America represents or is seen as representing are considered anathema to many traditional societies. That's a basic wellspring of many of the problems. And when you add resentment to it for the U.S.'s dominance internationally, and then in particular the role of the United States in the Persian Gulf, which many devout Muslims are outraged that the United States has forces in near holy areas in Saudi Arabia. And this is seen as a source of resentment, as is U.S. support for Israel, which is considered anti-Muslim by many radical groups. Hmm.
It is, again, the administration has said that they think that it is likely that it might be that the organization of Osama bin Laden is responsible for this act, and that they believe that Osama bin Laden is in Afghanistan. And further, the administration has said and made these very strong statements about the fact that anyone who harbors the people responsible should understand that we will hold them responsible and might well take action against them. What though exactly is the relationship, or do we know what the relationship is between the Taliban in Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden?
What we know about Afghanistan is very limited, but what little information we have points to a very close relationship between Osama bin Laden and the Taliban. Bin Laden has married into the family of Mullah Omar, who is the leader of the Taliban. He fought with Taliban commandos. His forces have at times aided the Taliban in their effort to consolidate power in Afghanistan. He has provided money for the Taliban. The Taliban, in turn, has allowed him a lot of leeway in Afghanistan to use training camps to train his followers, to communicate with others, and they're very aware of his activities. So these organizations are very, very close. And Taliban claims that they are not responsible for what bin Laden does do not ring true to me.
Although, so we would not expect, if we decided that that Osama bin Laden was responsible and we wanted to take action against him, we wouldn't expect that the Taliban would cooperate with us in that.
We've been asking for their cooperation for years now in going after bin Laden, and they've always given us a very cold shoulder. There's a sense of obligation to bin Laden that he fought with the Taliban, he fought with Afghans in general when they needed him. He supported them financially when they needed his help. And as a result, to turn on him now would not be honorable. And this is a particularly important sentiment in Afghanistan, where responsibility towards a guest is a paramount virtue. So any culture has a sense that betraying someone who helped you would be wrong. But in Afghanistan, it's asking a tremendous amount for the Taliban to turn him out. It would be very damaging for their own credibility internally to do so.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that we should expect in terms of support from governments in the Arab world, at least from those governments with whom we have friendly relations? Where do you think they would draw the line in what sort of action by the United States they would be willing to support?
That's a very difficult question, and I think the honest answer is we don't know yet. There have been statements of support by various Arab leaders, and they have been in the past willing to work with us very closely in fighting terrorism. That said, they are resistant to the idea of U.S. uses of force, particularly if that involves force attacks being mounted from their soil. So what you have is a very difficult dynamic for them, which is, on the one hand, they recognize the importance of being on the side of the world's only superpower. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's going to be tremendous popular frustration in their countries if they're seen as openly siding with the United States, particularly if U.S. attacks do not succeed or cause a lot of innocent casualties, which will be seen as further proof that the United States has evil intentions in the region.
Mm-hmm. So it might well be that these governments would be in a position where they might need to, for the benefit of the relationship with the United States, take a kind of a public posture, but for to deal with their own domestic situations. And it has to be noted that some of these governments have been criticized as being less than democratic. That they would have to then, for their own internal security concerns, they would in practice perhaps have to take another kind of position.
Absolutely, that there's going to be a split that I think different countries will resolve in different ways between how they manage public sentiment and how they manage their international relations.
We have another caller to bring the conversation, and they're in Mohammed, and they're on line number one. Let's do that. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was hoping perhaps the guest, I think he can manage this question.
Sure.
I'm wondering if we could get a brief overview of the history between the United States and Afghanistan. I know Cubans were fighting in Afghanistan, and their superpowers had some proxy war there for some time. And could you explain that one real briefly and then bring it up to the present?
Sure. It's a important question for understanding what's going on now.
Yeah.
The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and in support of what was a puppet government that it was trying to install. And there was resistance throughout Afghanistan to the Soviet invasion. This is in 1980. And the United States supported the resistance, which began as a very ragtag, limited effort, and over the years became very sophisticated, very impressive. And we used this essentially to bleed the Soviet Union. It was comparable to Vietnam for the Soviet Union, where they felt they were fighting a war they couldn't possibly win. The Soviets then pulled out at the end of the 1980s, and the United States did too. It had worked with Pakistan very closely and a few other countries, and it simply packed up its things and left. But the international Islamic connection that the United States had encouraged to fight the Soviets lived on after the United States left. Afghanistan fell into chaos, that rather than having a unified government in response to the Soviet pullout, the Afghan factions turned on each other and became involved in a very, very bloody civil war. In 1994, the Taliban emerged. They were from refugee camps in Pakistan along the Afghan-Pak border, and they were very motivated by a very, very strong idiosyncratic Islamic fervor, and they had very, very strong ties with the Pashtun community, that is one of Afghanistan's dominant communities. They, over the next, until now, in fact, they've been slowly consolidating their control over Afghanistan, either cooperating with local warlords to win their allegiance or defeating them militarily. They received tremendous support from Pakistan, military intelligence, and so on. And during this time of the Taliban control, Afghanistan slowly became a base for radical groups around the world, that it was a place where you could arm and train and organize, in part because it was very lawless for a while, in part because the Taliban was sympathetic to the goals of groups after it took power, and in part because there were other countries in the world where groups had organized in the past were less cooperative, and so Afghanistan became the only choice available for many groups.
And perhaps in some sense you've answered this question already, but why was it that the elements of the Mujahideen that we had supported because they were fighting against our enemy, the Soviet Union? Why was it that after that fight was over, the Soviet Union left, that some of these people decided that now we were the enemy?
These people had worked with the United States in the past because they saw the Soviet Union as the greatest threat to the Islamic cause and the greatest oppressor of Muslims. When the Soviet Union fell apart, the United States took on that role. And you had groups, not all of them by any means, but some groups that believed that they defeated one superpower successfully and they could do it again with another. And that this was the success against the Soviet Union, which was an incredible success, was an indication that their tactics, their way of fighting, their very cause were vindicated and they could do it again.
There is, I should be sorry to repeat it, but you know, there is this sort of old cliche about how the military is always preparing to fight the last war, and in this particular case, I guess now we will, in our the way that we decide to respond to what happened, we will try to put into place safeguards so that thing won't happen again. And I would expect then, though, a terrorist would say, well, okay, now you're going to try to defend against what happened last time, and then that means, obviously, we're going to do something different. How does one now start thinking about, you know, not only wanting to try to do what you can to prevent something like that happening again, but think about changing your strategy to deal with now what would no doubt be a shifting strategy by the people who would want to do something else like this?
It's an exceptionally difficult question. Terrorists have shown a remarkable ability to innovate in response to state countermeasures in the past. One of the reasons people believe that essentially plane bombs were used this time was because the United States has developed somewhat effective defenses against truck bombs. Mm-hmm. But there's a broader problem, which is it's very, very easy to kill undefended innocent people, that you can purchase weapons very easily, you can do a number of means that are innovative and new and kill people, and it's hard to defend against all of them, particularly in a free and open society. And that's a reason that many people fail to predict these sorts of attacks, is you focus on what groups have done in the past. But the other extreme is almost as dangerous, where you can imagine 1,000 apocalyptic scenarios of what groups might do, comparable in sophistication to what they did on September 11th. And we cannot defend against all of them. And we would waste a tremendous amount of resources and endanger certain fabrics of our society if we did try to defend against all of them. So we have to strike a balance between caution and imagination. And where you do that is with intelligence. Where you do is you try to gather intelligence as much as you can on groups. You try to study what they've done in the past, what they've considered, what is a plausible innovation for them and what is not plausible. But you also have to recognize that you'll be wrong from time to time, and that this is not perfect, and that mistakes are going to be made, and we're going to fail from time to time. And that's a frightening reality, but it's one we have to learn to live with.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I do want to mention, since I had said earlier that we thought there'd be this possibility that the Secretary of State will be having a news conference. Now the word that we have is that that news conference has been moved to 11:30. And once again, then, if and when it takes place and the coverage is provided to us from National Public Radio, we will do that so we can bring it to you. But so I can expect that we'll have the last 10 minutes here uninterrupted until we come to the end of the hour. And again, our guest is Dan Byman. He's director of RAND's Middle East Center in Washington, D.C. Do you think that U.S. policy in the Middle East is going to change as a result of what happened this week?
Absolutely. I think it'll change in many ways. I'll name a few that seem most obvious to me. One of which is the Middle East will be the center of our international agenda in a way it probably hasn't been since the 1990-1991 Gulf War, where we will focus our diplomatic energies, we'll focus our political energies on achieving the results we want in the Middle East. And recently, for obvious reasons, we've been focusing on Asia, we've been focusing on Europe, very important regions. But the Middle East in general will rise in importance. Second change I see is a shift in our policy towards Israel. There was a fairly widespread criticism and concern in the U.S. government over very aggressive Israeli counterterrorism policies, including Israeli attacks on Palestinian leaders. That sort of criticism, I think, is going to go away. I think that many people in the United States will now refrain from criticizing Israel along those lines because we will be confronting the same sorts of questions that Israel has long confronted. Mm. So we're going to see that shift as well. We're also going to see a lot more concern among our allies over what the United States is going to do, that many of our allies had reached kind of a comfortable diplomatic level where they had good relations with the United States, but they were not on the front page. It was not the sort of thing necessarily occupying the public mind. It will again, and our allies are going to have to confront that problem as well. Hmm.
I'm interested in just one of the comments you made, just simply because in some of the discussion that we've had on this so far, and we've heard from some people, and I have no idea whether this represent what sort of view this represents out in the population at large, but hearing from some people who said that in fact what they think that we should do is to re-examine our support for Israel and its policy. And in fact, not that we should support that policy, but that we should not. I wonder if you think that that's likely to be, there be a significant call, in fact, for not support, not greater support for Israel and its policy, particularly of the last couple of years, but less.
I think that will not happen for two reasons. The first is that supporting Israel less will not make a difference in terms of fighting groups like bin Laden. What they want is a complete rejection of what U.S. policy in the region, and indeed, in many ways, the U.S. way of life. And since we can't appease that, it's impossible to appease, making concessions on Israel would not achieve anything. But more importantly, Americans don't like to do anything under foreign pressure. If we as a nation had a debate and reconsidered our policy towards Israel for various reasons that are important to the United States, that would be one thing. But in the face of foreign pressure, I think the opposite is going to happen, that when you tell Americans with the threat of violence that they cannot do something, they're more likely to do it. So I think that most Americans will favor moving closer towards Israel rather than farther away.
Hmm. We have another caller here in Champaign. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is it possible in terms of the, I guess we'll call the Muslim mind, to accept what could be considered like a before-the-fact Marshall Plan? In other words, the way that we changed an awful lot of feelings of people to others, to foreigners, so to speak, after World War II seemed to be relatively successful in an outgoing context of the Marshall Plan. Now, could we, for example, not give arms, but give assistance to the people of Palestine to a percentage? Let's say first year it's 50% of what we give to Israel. Next year it's 60%, and then it works on up. But to allow the Palestinian people to build a country where they can have a pride, in other words, some sort of a an effort to rebuild, because they never really got bombed out like Europe did, and we needed the Marshall Plan. But is there a way to overcome this schism by having not military assistance, but building up Palestine in a way that overcomes this long tradition of hostility?
Two comments on that. The first is, whatever the United States or the West does in general, for the most radical groups like bin Laden, and again, I'm not talking about most Muslims or Arabs, I'm talking about a very, very small group of people, it will never be enough. There will always be something that could have been done that wasn't done. And going 70% of what they want, 80% of what they want, will not be enough. But, you know, more realistically, importantly, that sort of thing, I think, is out of the question politically for the United States. There's, in general, very low support for foreign assistance. But with regard to a Palestinian state, I think most Americans have etched in their memory pictures of many Palestinians celebrating the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings and being delighted with this. And those images are not overcome by a statement a day later by Palestinian leaders that they indeed were very sorry that these happened. There's a sentiment that the Palestinian people don't like Americans and are happy to see them suffer. Now, whether this is true or not, and I think it's certainly dangerous to make any conclusions on this, it's going to make foreign aid to Palestine an impossibility.
All right. We'd first, of course, have to get rid of the terrorist elements that supposedly fostered this current attack, which would be bin Laden, I assume, and some others. But it would seem to me there's got to be some change in orientation, there's really no way to respond to this other than an outgoing recognition that the Palestinian world is not whole.
But that is, I mean, certainly the Palestinian world is not whole, but it's the sort of thing that it's not going to make a difference if we recognize that or even work with it. These are groups that are opposed to much, they care much about far more than simply the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In fact, for many of these groups, that's a relatively minor component of their grievances of the United States. We tend to focus on that aspect when we think about the Middle East, but it's a much bigger region. There are many more issues. And we cannot simply focus on one particular issue and say, let's change what we're doing at the point of a bayonet and hope everything goes well, because, one, I don't think we're going to do it, and, two, I don't think it would work if we did.
We just have about 5 minutes left, and I have several other callers, and I know we won't get them all in this hour, but I'd like to get at least one more. We'll go to Champaign County for the next caller. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Well, there's so much to say, and I hope we hear some countervailing impressions. Having seen some of the images of Palestinian children dancing, you know, that is not something that policy should be built on, and people are going to use it in that fashion, but I think it's important to say that shouldn't be what policy is based on. It should be based on more justice. I don't expect Randy Fellow to agree this, but I also wanted to point out that the most successful car bombing in the Middle East was likely to be the 1976 car bombing, which was actually a collaboration by the CIA, the Mossad, and Saudi intelligence. Killed about 86 people, I think. That might be the biggest single quote-unquote successful car bombing terrorist attack. That was an attack on a Muslim cleric of some stripe or another. So the U.S. has been paying this out in kind and other wholesale terrorist kind of things for a while, and that's the dimension I think needs to be explored that hasn't been, except by one earlier caller who was then cut off by our resident Bush. I have to go.
All right. Well, Mr. Byman, again, you comment on that any way you like.
There's not much really to say to that. I mean, if I think, like most Americans, I don't think our government is perfect, but I trust it and stand behind it. And to try to blame ourselves for these actions is not only counterproductive, it's also mistaken, and we shouldn't even go in that direction.
Well, we'll try to get one more person here. This is Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Moving Shootish, and I just want to discuss something with Gus.
Yes.
And that's regarding the government that came to power after the fall of Najibullah in Kabul, the so-called Mujahideen government. I participated in two of the assemblies, in the Halwat Assembly in Kabul in January 1992-93 and in the Herat Assembly in 1994. And Pakistan refused to give visa or permit many of the Mujahideen representatives to come to these meetings. And when the Mujahideen went back to Islamabad to talk with the Pakistani government, then there was an agreement hammered by Nawaz Sharif, which was immediately, of course, was abrogated by several groups. So the Taliban, in fact, is a reaction to the destruction of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union. I studied the Taliban in 1983 in Pakistan when they were little boys. But in any case, they are here. In fact, nobody was against the United States. So what you see in Afghanistan has become a sort of sideshow for the Middle East. And so that what has metamorphosized the Mujahideen, who are pro-American, pro-peace, pro-democracy, that government was destroyed by Pakistan for various reasons that we do not have time to go through now. But what is happening now is, of course, that all these things in the media, and I do not know what would one can get of destroying Afghanistan, which is already destroyed. And well, in fact, in my view, the Pakistani government and its ISI intelligence service should give some accounting of if they have anything to do with the Taliban, which I'm sure they created it, and we in the United States supported it, that government, if not now, but quite a long time.
Mm.
Thank you.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. And we have a couple of minutes here left, and Mr. Byman, you can comment on that in any way that you feel that you can.
Well, the call raises an important point, which is the role of Pakistan in Afghanistan today. If we're going to have any solution to this problem, it has to involve Pakistan. And it might be with Pakistan's opposition, but Pakistan is the key foreign power operating in Afghanistan today. It's the key backer of the Taliban. And as a result, it has the most influence with the Taliban, and it could be our greatest opponent when we try to affect the Taliban. It could be our greatest friend. So we have to try to work with it, but also make it very clear to Pakistan that if they do not cooperate, the consequences will be serious.
I think that we're close to the point here that we're going to have to finish, and I'm sure we'll touch on some of these things in the next hour, and that for a long time to come, we'll be talking one way or another about this. And also, I do want to tell people who are listening that we will indeed try to provide different perspectives and are open to suggestions about various people that we might talk to or various ways that we could approach the topic. Any last thought perhaps you'd like to leave people with, Mr. Byman?
Only a counsel of patience that rushing to judgment as to who is responsible or what we should do is a recipe for disaster, that we will respond and we should respond, but that response should be something that has been received full consideration by our national leadership and the U.S. people, and doing so prematurely is going to be counterproductive.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Our guest, Dan Byman, director of RAND's Middle East Center in Washington, D.C.